Say hello to the Junco, a bird that at first glance does not seem all too glamorous, even to dedicated birdwatchers. But for scientists interested in evolution and animal behavior, the Junco is a rock star.
Look at that.
For nearly 100 years, Juncos have been the subject of groundbreaking scientific research.
Juncos have taught us a lot about ourselves. For example, how hormones like testosterone influence social behaviors. People are more like birds than we would ever have guessed.
The same bird that can be found in your backyard inhabits some of the most isolated and remote habitats on the continent.
If you went around the world, you wouldn't expect all people to look alike. When you go around the country, you don't find that all juncos look alike.
From the Appalachian Mountains of Virginia to the Black Hills of South Dakota and Wyoming's Grand Tetons, to the highlands of Guatemala, the mountains of Baja, and a remote island nearly 200 miles off the western coast of Mexico. Researchers set out to understand the behavior, physiology, and genetic makeup of a bird that is perhaps one of the world's greatest examples of diversification and rapid evolution.
If you want to understand evolution in action, the process of forming new species, then the Junco is the bird to study.
Now, evolution isn't something that happened a long time ago. It's something that happens every day. The complexity of the Junco can be subtle, but it can be obvious as well. And so you have a whole spectrum of variation from the gross to the subtles.
As Juncos continue to adapt to modern man and the changing climate around them, they introduce as many questions as answers.
So one of the big questions in evolutionary biology is how species are formed. What are the relative roles of natural selection and sexual selection and just random processes?
Join an international team of scientists on their quest for knowledge as they set out to understand the natural world by studying this amazing group of birds. And introduce yourself to the ordinary yet extraordinary Junco. William Rowan was an eccentric and talented man who had many interests, including art, writing, nature, and science. But perhaps his greatest passion was birds. Originally from Switzerland, he immigrated to Canada in 1919 to pursue a career as a biologist. For Rowan, the Canadian wilderness presented a highly underexplored outdoor laboratory, filled with biological discoveries waiting to be made. He was especially curious about bird migration, the annual journeys each spring and fall between breeding and wintering habitats. What was it that triggered birds to fly such great distances every year? How did they know when it was time to go and when it was time to return? Leading theories of the time suggested that temperature and barometric pressure were the key environmental cues that birds used to calibrate the seasonal changes in their biology. Rowan saw things differently. In 1924, Rowan accepted an offer from the University of Alberta to establish a new zoology program. It was there that he hypothesized that changing day length, not temperature or pressure, was the key environmental factor that triggered bird migration and reproduction. Further, he reasoned that if changing day length in any way affected the migratory impulse, it must do so through the seasonal growing and shrinking of the gonads. Rowan was not the first biologist to consider the importance of photoperiod, but he would be the first to directly test its role in animals. He devised an experiment involving a small population of captive birds that would be housed in two outdoor aviaries during the winter. The control group would be kept unmanipulated to to observe and use for comparison with the experimental group. The two aviaries would be identical. However, the experimental cage would also have electric lights that would be left on past dark into the winter nights to simulate the increasing length of days birds would experience in spring. This pioneering experiment would make Rowan famous. But it didn't come easy. University of Alberta president Henry Marshall Tory had very different ideas about science. For Tory, science belonged in the lab, and only the lab. In the 1920s, zoology was focused on lab studies of invertebrates, fish, and amphibians. Many regarded studying birds, especially in the field, as a foolish scientific pursuit.
With the birds. It's a waste of time.
Tory repeatedly discouraged Rowan and gave stern warnings to give up on his ornithological research. Fortunately for science, Rowan didn't listen, and he carried out his fieldwork in secrecy. As the nights got longer and the temperatures dropped, he made his day-length experiment a reality, working in secrecy on his own property on nights and weekends. The bird he chose to work with was the dark-eyed junco, a common wintering songbird in Alberta that migrated northwards each spring. Juncos were an easy choice, as they were abundant in small flocks, easy to capture, and thrived in captivity. The experimental juncos received electric light well into the night for 3 months, with the duration of light increasing 5 minutes per day to simulate spring and early summer. Except for the artificial lights, the birds lived in winter conditions. In fact, it was an especially cold winter, even by Canadian standards. Every 2 weeks, Rowan recorded behavioral observations and measured the size of individual birds' gonads. And just as Rowan had hypothesized, the increasing light caused the experimental junco's gonads to increase in size. And by the end of the study, they courted and sang as if it were spring. Day breaks over the lush forest of Mountain Lake, Virginia. A male dark-eyed junco is up at dawn, singing defiantly. His song signals the ownership of territory. The days are getting longer as the month of May rolls along. Breeding season is in full swing. The stakes are high. Males must defend a territory and attract a mate in order to get a chance at reproducing. Breeding pairs must compete for food, not only to feed themselves, but also to nourish their offspring. There will be winners and losers each year. Some pairs will produce up to 15 young, while most will fail altogether. Males must balance the conflicting demands of survival versus reproduction and the urge to court additional mates versus caring for their own young. Understanding how such choices are determined has perplexed biologists for a long time. For researchers who study evolution and behavior at the nearby Mountain Lake Biological Station, the breeding season is also a busy time. And morning is a critical part of the day.
Like most field biologists, I take a lot of pleasure in being alone in the field. Mountain Lake is often misty and cool in the morning, with the leaves dripping, and the forest feels close and dark. Morning is also a great time to find out what the birds are doing, to learn their secrets, and to see them on their own terms. My name is Ellen Ketterson, and I'm a professor of biology at Indiana University, and I've been studying the junco really for a very long time. I've been conducting research at Mountain Lake Biological Station for nearly 30 years now. I first came in 1979 with my husband, Val Nolan, and we found this was a truly fantastic place to do research. And the bird we were interested in, are still interested in, the junco, is very abundant here.
Juncos are simple but elegant little birds. You can recognize them by their pale underbellies and white tail feathers, which they flash when they fly. The junco is often called the snowbird, a name likely given to them in the eastern United States, where they arrive in the autumn and stay through the winter, only to migrate away in the spring.
Juncos are like people. One of the reasons for studying birds and not studying mammals, most mammals, is that birds form pair bonds, just as people form couples. And when birds take care of their offspring, usually the male helps. If you ask me why I've studied the junco for so long, I would say in part because it's so amenable to study. It really lets you study it. Juncos live on the ground. It's possible to study them without climbing trees. They build their nests on the ground, so you can find them. They thrive in captivity, so you can provide them with seeds, or put them in different social configurations. And they're content. They actually reveal their biology to you. We're able to study them in naturalistic settings in our aviaries at Indiana University, where we can provide large cages and let the birds live almost naturally as they would in the field. In the aviary, you can manipulate diet, you can manipulate sex ratio, you can look at the birds at different times of year and learn things that would be much more difficult to pursue in the field. And just like Rowan, nearly a century ago, we can manipulate daylight. But really, the core focus of the research is the fieldwork, what we can learn by studying the birds in their natural habitat.
And so here's a nest about 6 feet up in this root mass. And it's not active, but it's a complete nest from earlier this season.
In general, in a downpour, that nest should stay dry and the female sitting on the nest can stay dry. Females will look for almost a natural cavity or a place that has roots or grass or something on top of the nest that will keep it dry. But if the rain were the right direction, it could get wet. But the female would protect the babies with their own body if it were raining fairly hard. But it's at least mostly protected from the rain. And it's amazing, some of these nests, it could rain for days. And then we go to check them and they're just bone dry.
I think it may be surprising to some people that we can walk around in the woods and look at birds and understand something about science. There's nothing really, at first glance, unusual about the junco. It's just a little gray bird and it's everywhere.
It's usually about 7 or 8 people of various ages and backgrounds, and people all interested in the same thing, and we're all interdependent in that we all need to have certain things accomplished. We all often depend on having nests found, so that's a collective effort. And that's a big part of the job, and one that I find the most enjoyable. So for 15 summers, I've spent almost every day in the woods looking for these nests, and I somehow never get really tired of it.
Natural selection has done a pretty good job making sure that their nests are hidden. You have to work really hard to outwit them.
You might have a slump of maybe 2 days where you don't find anything, and then then suddenly a bird flushes up from your feet and in a place you didn't expect a nest to be after you had looked all over the obvious places. And so that's a true joy that I always come back with. And you come back to the lab and say, I found the nest, and no one else could find it. So there's a little competition amongst the group who who's the best nest finder.
Locating nests is important because it allows the team to monitor breeding pairs and the offspring they produce each season. Another major job every summer is to keep every bird in the population banded with a unique set of leg bands. The first time each bird is captured, either as an adult or as a nestling, lightweight aluminum and colored plastic bands are wrapped around their legs. So when they're spotted in the field, even if it's just a quick look through binoculars, it's possible to tell who's who. This bird has a silver over a red band on his left leg and a light blue on his right. He is known as light blue, silver over red. To capture adult birds, researchers bring lightweight nylon nets called mist nets into the field, which are set up between two poles staked securely into the ground. A good mist net is set up in the shade or in front of a dark background so that it appears virtually invisible to the birds. Seed bait and a playback of a junco's territorial song are commonly used to lure them into the nets. When juncos hit, they are caught out of midair but are not harmed, and researchers are trained to remove them from the net promptly and safely. Once in the hand, a wide variety of data are collected in just a few minutes. Measurements like wing, tail, and bill length, and body mass are recorded. Birds are screened for external parasites such as mites or lice, and photos are taken to quantify the size or color of social badges, like the amount of white in the tail. Perhaps most importantly, just a few drops of blood are collected from a vein in the wing. The bird is released back into nature, but the small blood sample will go to the lab to provide a wealth of information for years to come. From just a tiny drop of blood, researchers can measure genetics, immune function, and nutritional state, and screen for diseases such as avian malaria. The blood also allows scientists to measure levels of hormones that regulate reproduction and sexual behavior. Among these hormones is testosterone. Most people know of testosterone as the male hormone that's related to muscle mass, aggression, and sexual behavior. But testosterone also modulates a whole host of other behavioral and physiological functions in both males and females. This knowledge is taken for granted, but as recently as the late 1980s, much less was known about the importance of hormones in natural populations. For over a decade, the Ketterson and Nolan lab conducted a groundbreaking field experiment, which shed light on testosterone's complex effects.
Two traits that we've been interested in for a long time are mating behavior and parental behavior. Lots of people had been studying polygynous birds, or polyandrous birds, where multiple females mate with one male or multiple males mate with one female. But really most birds mate monogamously, about 90% of bird species. And we wanted to know why that was. And the best way to pursue a question like that is to alter the birds so that they exhibit different parental behavior or different mating systems. And then you can ask whether their reproductive success or their survival is the same. Is it better to be the way they are, or would they be better in some alternative configuration? So it's an experimental approach to the evolution of life histories.
Ketterson and Nolan designed an experiment utilizing testosterone to alter the biology of male juncos. Two groups were implanted with capsules under the skin throughout the breeding season each year. The experimental males got capsules that secreted testosterone, resulting in elevated levels, while the control birds received empty capsules. Over the course of 13 years, researchers documented how the increased testosterone altered the social behavior, physiology, reproductive success, and survival of both groups. They attached radio transmitters to the birds' backs in order to monitor movement and map the size of the territory each male defended. They also recorded how often each male sang his territorial song. On average, testosterone-implanted males defended larger territories and sang territorial songs more often when compared to controls. The larger territories and more frequent singing both indicated that the males with high testosterone levels were investing more effort into attracting and retaining mates. But would these behavioral changes lead to greater mating success or higher reproductive output? Juncos are socially monogamous, with one male and one female defending a territory and caring for one nest at a time. But juncos are also sometimes unfaithful to their partners, mating and siring offspring outside their social pair bonds. This makes it necessary to use DNA fingerprinting to determine the biological father of each nestling. Using methods similar to a human paternity test, DNA samples were collected from all the adults and nestlings hatched during the study, and genetic markers were used to assign parentage. All the males in the study, whether they had testosterone implants or not, behaved as if they were monogamous, attracting a single female mate with whom they defended a territory and built a nest. But the paternity tests revealed that testosterone-treated males were much more likely to mate with neighboring females outside their social pair bond. Control males, on the other hand, were more likely to remain monogamous, even if their partners were not. This meant that eggs fertilized by testosterone-treated males often ended up in the control male's home nests, and that the control males cared for nestlings that were not their kin. On average, the high testosterone males mated with more females than control males did, and these additional mates led to a greater total number of nestlings produced by the high testosterone males.
So it seemed that having higher testosterone is very beneficial, conferring higher fitness in terms of the numbers of offspring produced or the number of mates that a male attracts. But that's really only half the equation. The quality of the offspring matters. And it also matters whether the male survives to reproduce again in each subsequent season.
Offspring quality is influenced by the amount of parental care that nestlings receive. This behavior was measured by recording the number of feeding trips parents made to the nest each hour. In addition, nestlings were weighed and growth rates were calculated. Control males fed their young much more frequently, nearly twice as often as the high testosterone males, indicating that the elevated testosterone was suppressing male parental care. As a result, nestlings with high testosterone fathers grew more slowly, making them less likely to survive into adulthood. The final piece of the puzzle was examining the impact of the experimentally increased testosterone on survival.
When we census the population each year, we found that the males treated with testosterone were less likely to return. Their annual rate of survival was about half that of the control males. And what we thought we were seeing was the cumulative effect of a lot of small changes in behavior and physiology that made life just slightly more perilous for a male treated with testosterone. So if it's how many mates you acquire or how many offspring you produce, then a male benefits from having higher levels of testosterone. But if it's the quality of the offspring he produces or how long he lives, then it's more beneficial for a male to have lower testosterone. And what our study showed is that it's possible to take all those components of fitness and put them together and calculate a net lifetime reproductive success.
The testosterone studies are just one of many diverse topics explored by the Ketterson and Nolan Research Group. Since 1976, the lab has published over 150 articles across a range of scientific journals, all from studies of the dark-eyed junco.
Over the years, we've studied a lot of different topics in juncos. We've studied migration, disease ecology, immune function, mating systems. One of the things I've learned is while the bird may have remained the same, the questions were always changing. There's a lot to be gained by studying a single bird over a long period of time because the bird leads you to places you never expected to go.
Across their breeding, wintering, and year-round ranges, dark-eyed juncos inhabit nearly all of the U.S. and Canada, making them one of the continent's most common and abundant songbirds. But depending on where you've seen them, your concept of what a dark-eyed junco looks like will vary from place to place. For example, the juncos studied at Mountain Lake, Virginia, are part of a uniformly gray, slate-colored group that breed across Alaska, Canada, and the mountains of New England and Appalachia. But farther west, other groups of dark-eyed juncos appear strikingly different. The northwest corner of the state of Wyoming is home to some of the most iconic scenery and impressive wildlife in America, attracting millions of tourists every year. The Grand Tetons' rugged mountains are one popular destination, rivaled only by the geysers and geothermal attractions found at Yellowstone National Park. A certain group of dark-eyed juncos also makes an annual visit to this region, but they're not here to see Old Faithful. Instead, they come to breed in the lush mountain forests during the spring and summer months, taking advantage of the mild temperatures and abundance of insects. Named for the colored feathers on their flanks, these pink-sided juncos also have brown on their backs and wings, features that clearly distinguish them from the slate-colored juncos. The breeding range of pink-sided juncos is restricted to high-elevation forests in the Rocky Mountains of Wyoming and Montana, a smaller range when compared to their slate-colored counterparts. Moving farther west, another group known as the Oregon juncos can be found breeding in forest and woodland habitats ranging from British Columbia to Southern California. On average, Oregon juncos are smaller in size. Their brown backs are similar to pink-sided juncos, yet their dark hoods could make them pass for an entirely different species. In the mountains of eastern California, Nevada, and Utah, juncos take on yet another distinct look. Here, their heads and bodies are a muted gray, giving them the name gray-headed juncos. But perhaps a more distinguishing feature is the bright red patch of feathers on their upper back. Throughout North America, juncos typically breed in forest and woodland habitats, which are found at either high latitudes or high elevations. These environments can look as different from one another as the birds themselves, but all of them have common features that juncos require: trees, shade, grass, and ground cover for nesting and foraging. Among the most extreme climates inhabited by dark-eyed juncos is the Black Hills of South Dakota, home to the white-winged junco. The rugged open landscape is dotted by ponderosa pines. Brutally cold winters turn into scorching summers. The dry conditions make the area susceptible to wildfires, and juncos are among the first animals to move back into recently burned habitats. This makes them a useful indicator species for wildlife managers. White-winged juncos are the largest of all the juncos, and they also have the most white in their tail feathers. They get their name from the white bars on their wings, a feature that is thought to be a social ornament. Ornamental feather colors such as white tails, dark hoods, bright backs, and colored sides are used to attract mates and establish social dominance. These traits distinguish the different dark-eyed junco groups, raising the question, why are birds that look so different classified as a single species? At the Natural History Museum in San Diego, California, curator Phil Unit oversees a research collection containing nearly 50,000 birds. Highlights of the collection include exotic parrots and giant eagles, but still the ordinary, extraordinary junco is among Phil's favorites.
The junco is especially interesting to me because perhaps more than any other bird of North America, it has really conspicuous variation that still seems to be within one species. The complexity of the junco can be subtle, but it can be obvious as well. And so you have a whole spectrum of variation from the gross to the subtle. You know, gross difference between an Oregon junco from the Pacific Northwest and a gray-headed junco. No one ever would think those are the same species.
In examining the specimens by hand, researchers can collect detailed measurements of color, shape, and size, and make comparisons among different groups. Museum collections exist today due to the tireless efforts of field ornithologists, men and women like Alden Miller, a professor at Berkeley, who in the 1930s set out on a decade-long quest to catalog and classify all the juncos across North America. Miller wanted to understand the process of diversification. He spent months at a time in the field, capturing juncos, mapping their locations, and taking detailed measurements of color, shape, and size. Examining an astounding 11,774 junco specimens in the process. In the end, he identified 21 distinct groups of juncos across the continent. 15 of these groups inhabited the U.S. and Canada and had the common trait of dark brown eyes. These dark-eyed juncos could be lumped into 6 distinct groups that looked quite different from one another, and each group had its own breeding range. But Miller made a curious observation. In the zones where the different juncos' ranges met, it seemed that they could easily interbreed. For example, where the gray-headed junco and the Oregon junco's ranges meet in the mountains of Nevada, it's not uncommon to observe the two subspecies producing offspring together. Here, an Oregon junco mother tidies up and removes a nestling fecal sac. Moments later, the gray-headed father arrives with food. The hybrid offspring of mixed junco pairs are fertile and have traits blended from both parents. Their ability to interbreed in nature is the primary reason dark-eyed juncos are currently classified as a single species. But this left Miller puzzled. Why could groups that looked so different interbreed so freely? He hypothesized that they were all closely related. But limited by the tools of his era, Miller had no way to further explore their evolutionary history. Today, Dr. Borja Mila from Madrid's National Museum of Natural Sciences has taken up Miller's quest.
This has puzzled ornithologists for over a century. You know, how can two juncos that look so different in terms of plumage type, how can they interbreed so easily when they come into contact? Of course, Miller, what he had was things like patterns of plumage color or eye color or bill color and how those change across space. Now we have this very powerful tool, which is the DNA. And within DNA, we have like a footprint of the evolutionary history of the group. Genetic work has become an indispensable tool in the study of evolutionary relationships and the study of speciation in general. We can actually compare different populations or different species in terms of the divergence in the DNA sequence of a certain gene of interest.
Using DNA from blood or feathers, researchers sequence specific gene fragments from multiple populations or species. The sequences are aligned, and the mutations that differ can be compared.
So two populations can be identical genetically, or they can differ by several mutations. And quantifying that amount of divergence is very useful to then reconstruct a phylogenetic tree, like a genealogical tree that allows us to understand the evolutionary history of the group.
In this example, populations B, C, and D share a mutation in the third base pair that distinguishes them from population A, suggesting that these groups likely share a common ancestor that diverged from population A in the past. Also, populations C and D share a mutation in the eighth base pair that distinguishes them from population B, indicating that C and D are the most closely related and share a recent common ancestor. Population D also has a unique mutation that distinguishes it from population C. Because all four genetic sequences are quite similar, they likely share a common ancestor farther back in time.
Once we have put together these evolutionary relationships between the different species or populations, we can actually understand better how these different physical characteristics, like plumage color or eye color, changes with time. Another very useful tool to us is what we call molecular clocks. Because we know that some parts of the genome mutate at constant rate, we can calibrate that rate, and then for a given level of divergence, we know that it's equivalent to a certain amount of years.
Mila and his team used a mitochondrial DNA fragment called cytochrome oxidase 1 that typically distinguishes even closely related species of birds. Based on known divergence times from other species, the molecular clock of this gene has been estimated to tick at a rate of approximately 2% sequence divergence every 1 million years. But for the dark-eyed juncos, the genetic sequences were so similar that it was impossible to construct a typical evolutionary tree. Instead, the six major groups clustered together, more like a bush, all differentiated from a common ancestor, the yellow-eyed junco, which inhabits the highlands of Mexico and Central America.
Between dark-eyed junco forms, we find very few genetic differences. And that means different lineages, even though they look very different in terms of plumage, they're extremely young. So they diverged very, very recently, just a few thousand years ago. In fact, we know this happened after the last glacial maximum, which took place about 20,000 years ago. So this, in evolutionary terms, is extremely recent. So this helps us to understand this capacity for interbreeding, which was very difficult to understand otherwise. And genetic data allows us to obtain a date for when that divergence happened.
Combining Alden Miller's data on geography and physical characteristics with Borja Mila's genetic results finally allows for a comprehensive explanation of dark-eyed junco diversification.
I think what's unique about the junco radiation is that it's two things. It's that it's very rapid, but also that it's very recent. That about, you know, perhaps 10 to 20,000 years ago, this yellow-eyed junco from the highlands of Mexico expanded northward and recolonized North America as the glaciers receded right after the last glacial maximum. And as these populations recolonized North America, they changed eye color from yellow to dark. Also the bill changed from bicolor to a pink colored bill. And then we have, as populations came isolated in different parts of North America, they also evolved different plumage types, giving rise to the different dark-eyed juncos that we see today, including the slate color, the gray-headed, the pink-sided Oregons, etc.
It might be surprising to learn that the common dark-eyed junco represents one of the most stunning examples of rapid diversification in the entire animal kingdom. But there would be even more surprises to come as researchers set out to examine other junco forms found south of the border.
It is interesting, once you get used to something like the dark-eyed junco in the Appalachians, you come to think of that as a junco. And of course, there are other types of juncos, other juncos that have other characteristics in different parts of the world. And so when I first saw that junco that was in the highlands of Guatemala, I guess I was pretty excited.
Of these things.
My God, that eye is so yellow. It's like satanic. I mean, I don't know if I'm comfortable with that.
Look at the belly, too.
It's huge.
It's like there's no...
That yellow eye just was unbelievable. To go from studying a dark-eyed junco to seeing one that had an eye that looked like it was on fire was a kind of a shock.
Oh, man, look at that.
What the f***?
Suddenly I had this junco in the hand that was a junco, but just... its eye looked like it was piercing my own. It was pretty striking to me.
Yellow-eyed juncos have historically been classified as a single species that inhabits high elevation forests of Mexico and Central America, as well as small portions of the southwestern U.S. But a closer look within the yellow-eyed juncos reveals at least three groups that have distinct geographic ranges and subtle but clear differences in feather coloration and physical traits. The mountaintops inhabited by the juncos in Baja and Guatemala are small and isolated ranges, and yellow-eyed juncos don't migrate, leading researchers to hypothesize that these groups might be heading off on their own evolutionary trajectories, perhaps even representing different species. Up until now, there was little information available to evaluate just how differentiated these groups might be. Recently, members of the Ketterson Lab at Indiana University joined Dr. Borja Mila from Spain's National Science Museum on a field expedition to study yellow-eyed juncos across their range. The first destination was the highlands of Guatemala, where intact forests are few and far between. Centuries of farming and constant demand for firewood have nearly stripped the mountains bare. One exception is a forest reserve near the indigenous community of Todos Santos Chichin in the Cuchamatanes Mountains, where local residents retain the language, dress, and customs of their Mayan ancestors. Permission to enter the reserve is closely guarded by the village elders, which helps ensure that the area will remain a safe haven for the diversity of flora and fauna found in this unique habitat. The reserve covers more than 15,000 acres, and it includes the area's highest mountains at over 12,000 feet above sea level.
This area of the highland of Guatemala is under a very serious threat of deforestation. The communities, the indigenous communities that live here, have very few resources. But the indigenous community has decided to preserve this large area of forest to keep the water flowing into the communities and have wood resources. It's a very small area and it's under very strong threat, together with other endemics found here, like the Goldman's warbler. There's also very isolated populations of the broad-tailed hummingbird. There's a very differentiated pine siskin here. So a very important area with potentially a very differentiated set of taxa. And that increases the conservation value of this area very much. So we have here a Guatemala junco. Right now it's considered to be a race of the yellow-eyed junco, but there's several phenotypic differences between this bird and the other yellow-eyed juncos in Chiapas and in the rest of Mexico and in Baja California. It's much a much more olive gray, duskier gray on the head. The back has this olive wash on the brown, so it's not as reddish. And it has much less white on the tail feathers compared to northern juncos, like the dark-eyed and other races. And what we do is we come here, we set up nets, and then we use recordings, playbacks of the male song to attract the birds to the nets. So we capture them. And then once we have it in the hand, we're able to take all kinds of measurements, morphological measurements of, you know, wing, the bill, the tail, the tarsus. We take a blood sample for the genetic analysis, and then we put an aluminum band that's uniquely numbered, and then we release them.
With just 3 days to spend in Guatemala, time was of the essence. Luckily, the birds and the weather both cooperated, allowing the team to collect the data they needed before moving on. The city of San Cristobal in Chiapas, Mexico, lies just 100 miles northwest of the reserve in Guatemala. But to get there, the team had to drive down through the Isthmus of Tehuantepec, a hot, moist, lowland tropical valley that separates the mountaintop ranges of the Guatemalan and Mexican juncos. San Cristobal is a city where the old meets the new. As one of Mexico's best-preserved Spanish colonial towns, picturesque historical architecture and open-air markets fuel a vibrant tourist economy. But just outside the old city, the modern challenges of urban sprawl, pollution, deforestation, and mining threaten the abundance of the region's valuable natural resources. Fortunately, there is a growing movement to promote sustainable forestry and protect biodiversity. And among the beneficiaries of such efforts is the yellow-eyed junco. In the mountains just outside San Cristobal, Noé Beltrán, a local forester, has established a private ecological park. The goal of the park is to promote the coexistence of nature and sustainable resource extraction. For every tree that is cut, 10 are planted.
La reserva tiene 146 hectáreas. Es decir, es un predio grande para estas áreas. La tierra alrededor de San Cristóbal de las Casas ya resulta muy reducida porque ha crecido la población. Claro. Y entonces hay una gran presión poblacional para hacer estas áreas habitacionales, ¿no? O sea, las montañas. Yeah. Y las montañas entonces pues desaparece todo el bosque.
This intact piece of highland forest provided a perfect site to collect samples and song recordings from the Mexican yellow-eyed junco in Chiapas. Birds use their songs to attract mates and announce territorial ownership to rivals. If songs from different populations are quite distinct, then the birds may be unlikely to recognize one another as the same species. The Mexican yellow-eyed junco's geographic range is quite large, so it was important to collect data from an additional race within this group. It was a 2-day drive to Mexico City, where the team met up with a local ornithologist, Adán Oliveras. Adán took the team to a volcanic mountain called El Ajusco, just outside the city. He explained that this important conservation area used to be pristine and peaceful, but recent years have seen an increase in recreation and pollution from Mexico City's growing population. The forests of oak, pine, and fir on these high volcanoes provide habitat for varieties of birds, small mammals, and reptiles unique to this area. Endemic populations are those plants and animals found nowhere else in the world. They typically develop where geographic isolation allows them to diverge without gene flow from neighboring populations. Endemism is common on island chains such as Hawaii and the Galapagos, but it also occurs in high-elevation forests, like those found on El Ajusco, in Chiapas, and in Guatemala, where unique types of yellow-eyed juncos are found. Scientists don't always agree on whether or not local endemic groups should be called separate species. One of the most widely accepted definitions, known as the biological species concept, defines species based on whether or not they are able to interbreed. But for populations found in geographically isolated locations, it is impossible to know whether they would interbreed in nature if given the chance. In these situations, biologists must define species based on how genetically and physically distinct they are from one another. Whether or not a local population is classified as a unique species can be a critical distinction. It can even make the difference between receiving protection and habitat conservation versus being overlooked and facing extinction.
Juncos are interesting because they tend to inhabit these high elevation patches of forest. So you might consider these sky islands. That's one of the names that they give for these patches that are separated from one another by what you might consider oceans of desert. One of the ideas is that in these patches of forest is where they've diversified. So they've become isolated from other populations. And in this sort of splendid isolation, you might call it, they have diverged from their brothers and sisters and have kind of gone off in different evolutionary directions.
Arguably, the most impressive sky island on the continent can be found on the southern tip of the Baja Peninsula. Here, a small mountain range rises out of the desert to nearly 7,000 feet, just 20 miles inland from the coast. While nearly all of Baja is extremely dry, the highest elevations trap enough moisture to allow a tiny patch of forest to exist. But getting up into this roadless wilderness wouldn't be easy, so the team employed the assistance of some local guides.
We are about to head up to the Sierra de la Laguna, to the top of the very highest part of the Sierra where the pine forest is and where the juncos are and many other endemics. Now we're in a tropical deciduous forest, and we'll climb through oak, and then we'll get up onto the pine oak at around 1,000 meters. It's gonna be a beautiful climb, but it's gonna be like a 7-hour climb. These are local people. They have, these are their mules for their work, really, because they have extensive cattle around here. And, you know, when someone wants to go up to the Sierra, because there's no roads, then you can hire their mules, and they act as guides. So it's typically people that are interested in nature, because it's not a very touristy area. Nobody gets out here.
For Junco work, this is the most remote that I've ever been, and every other site that we've worked, we've been able to drive fairly close, at least, to the location. I feel like I'm in pretty good shape, but yeah, it was tough. Uphill for 6.5 hours. Every foot strike, your feet slip a little bit. That's fine the first hour. The last hour, that was killing me. I remember the last hour, just one foot in front of the other, just try and make it up. I mean, I was pretty darn exhausted.
Right when we hit that forest, we started to see juncos just right along the trail, passing by them. They didn't fly away like I would have expected, you know, and I thought, well, maybe that was just a tame pair that is used to seeing people hiking along the trail. But everywhere throughout the forest up here, the birds are super tame, which is especially surprising since it is such a wilderness, remote kind of area. It's not because they're used to hanging out with people. So this tameness we see here is due to something else besides habituation. We call it like insular tameness, where we see in a lot of different animals, in island populations, they colonize an area and escape a lot of the predators that might have been there, and they become really tame. So something like that may be going on here. In general, at first glance, the Baird's Junco here looks like any of the other yellow-eyeds we might see. But once we got some, you know, in our binoculars in the hand and take a closer look, there's a lot of striking differences. Particularly, one of the things that struck me was how small they were. Also, the whole color appearance is much paler, almost like an overexposed photograph looks sort of washed out.
Really, the plumage of Baird's Junco conforms to what's called Gloger's rule, which postulates that in drier habitats, birds have lighter, paler colors in the plumage, and in the north, in moister habitats, the darker and more deep colors. So this actually applies to this form of Junco.
This is an endemic form of the American robin that only occurs in this mountain range. And as you can see, similar to some of the other species we're seeing here, the bird is very washed out in color. And on the front, most people think of the red robin. It can have a very red breast. Here is just almost a pale yellow. Most people, when they think of robins, and even the species name indicates it with Turdus migratorius, is that it is a migratory species. However, here in the Sierra de la Laguna, it has become sedentary.
While the Junco crew focused on capturing and processing juncos and recording their songs, a team of Mexican government biologists, led by Ricardo Rodriguez Estrella, was busy collecting data from many other birds found on the mountain. Meanwhile, the cowboys made sure everyone was well-fed and watered, and that coffee, vaquero style, was always at the ready. Spending time in the field with international collaborators in such a beautiful and remote setting was a special opportunity for the biologists, not only to collect data, but also to simply make observations and have discussions that would lead to future research questions. Armed with new DNA samples, Mila and McCormick were ready to test the question of just how closely related the different yellow-eyed junco groups might be. Prior findings from the dark-eyed juncos across the U.S. and Canada had revealed that despite striking differences in plumage coloration, these groups were extremely close genetically, and they are able to interbreed in nature. In comparison, plumage differences among the yellow-eyed junco groups are subtle, yet the genetic data revealed that, in fact, these groups were highly differentiated genetically. Both the Guatemala junco and the Baja junco proved to be genetically distinct from the rest of the yellow-eyed juncos in mainland Mexico, and the amount of genetic sequence differentiation indicates that they have been on their own evolutionary trajectories since they diverged from a common ancestor approximately 500,000 years ago. The amount of genetic differentiation, the discrete physical differences, and geographic isolation all indicate that both the Baja junco and the Guatemala junco should be considered separate and unique junco species. The discovery that these juncos should be classified as unique species will have important implications for their future protection, and also for the many other endemic plants and animals found in their respective habitats. But there was still a missing piece of the junco's evolutionary history in Mexico. Still to be studied was the most mysterious, isolated, remote, and endangered junco of them all. Not all juncos that live in Mexico have yellow eyes, and not all of them inhabit the main continent. 150 miles west from the coast of Baja, a small island rises from the depths of the Pacific Ocean. Measuring just 22 miles long by 7 miles wide, Guadalupe Island is home to a mysterious population of juncos. Little is known about them because getting there is complicated. The only way to reach Guadalupe is to hitch a ride with the Mexican Navy from the port of Ensenada. Guadalupe and the surrounding islands are protected ecological reserves, and access is strictly limited. No civilian ships are allowed to land. The Navy makes bi-monthly supply missions to provide basic necessities to a tiny fishing village and a small naval outpost. Only a handful of biologists and conservationists are allowed to tag along, to study and protect the many endemic plants and animals found on the islands. For Dr. Ellen Ketterson, who has spent nearly 40 years studying juncos, getting to the Guadalupe Island population fulfilled a lifelong dream. Along with her collaborator, Dr. Borja Mila, the research team set out to collect some of the first modern data and samples from the mysterious Guadalupe junco. Traveling through the night at speeds up to 30 knots, it took nearly 24 hours of nonstop sailing before land was in sight.
The thing that blows my mind is how the juncos got out here. So this ship is going pretty fast all night long, so we're like a couple hundred miles from the Baja coast, and it's one thing to see it on a map, but to get out here and imagine how you could have a flock of juncos make it this far out into the ocean and then just happen to find suitable habitat, just found a population, is kind of mind-blowing. But if you think about the probability, millions of dispersing birds over hundreds of thousands of years, probability becomes a possibility, and hopefully we'll find them soon.
It's a very unique experience because it's getting to a very isolated place. This is a volcano that came out 5 kilometers, so it goes well into the depth, and then above that we have 1.3 kilometers. So the whole thing is 6.3 kilometers. If you take away the water, it would be much larger than any mountain in America. Getting there is very, very impressive, and you will see the trees on top of the ridge, and you will see fabulous cliffs, some of them close to 1 kilometer high. So it's fabulous, fabulous geology. Not very old, it's 8 million years old, and it's amazing what evolution can do in 8 million years old. It's more or less the age of the Galapagos, more or less the age of Hawaii. And you see what evolution does. Usually we think that it needs thousands of millions of years, but no, in 8 million years you get a lot of unique things there. You will see the elephant seals and the Laysan albatross, and then the puppies of the Guadalupe fur seal. It's an amazing thing to observe and experience.
Landing on the southern end of the island, it would still take several hours to drive to where juncos could be found. Today, most of the island is a stunning but tragically barren landscape covered with invasive grasses. In the early 1800s, French and Russian sailors found Guadalupe covered with trees and native plants. More than 40 endemic organisms found nowhere else in the world, including flowers, birds, mammals, and spiders, once called Guadalupe home. But the introduction of goats to feed the sailors had devastating ecological consequences. With no predators, over 100,000 goats were soon running wild, stripping the island of nearly all of its native vegetation, resulting in several extinctions. After decades of battling the goats, Mexican conservationists from the NGO Conservación de Islas finally eradicated them in 2007. The heavenly setting that could once be found throughout the island is now limited to small patches of recovering habitat on the northern end.
And then once you get to the top, you won't believe it. You will be on top of the clouds, but then you will walk, and then you will have the clouds below you. So you are actually like living on paradise, and that is like being in Guadalupe. It's like being on paradise on earth. You will have the birds, the juncos, saying good morning every morning. It's paradise on earth.
Along with a handful of other forest birds, the Guadalupe juncos inhabit a mere 300 acres of cypress groves, all that remains of the forests that once covered the entire island. The limited habitat supports only a few hundred breeding pairs. The island is extremely dry, making the forest patches susceptible to wildfires. A single cigarette butt, or wayward campfire, could literally wipe out the junco population in a matter of hours. In such a dry habitat, birds are quickly attracted to even the smallest sources of water. The scientists found an abundance of juvenile juncos, which lack the richer plumage colorations of the adults. The high number of juveniles indicates that the juncos are reproducing successfully, despite the limited habitat and threat of introduced predators. The juncos and other birds on Guadalupe are extremely tame, a phenomenon observed on many islands, where colonizing animals evolve in the absence of predators they left behind on the mainland. With so little known about the juncos here, the team set out to collect basic information on the bird's physical characteristics, behaviors, and songs. And importantly, blood samples were collected for a long-awaited genetic analysis of the Guadalupe junco's evolutionary history.
We made it to the island of Guadalupe off Baja California, and this is an endemic junco race. We don't really know yet if it's a race or a separate species, that's what we're working on, but very brown, no red on the back, that's new. One difference though is the bill is much longer and pointier than in the other species in the mainland. And we have quite a bit of white compared to the races in Guatemala and Chiapas. So this would be more similar to the dark-eyed juncos in the north. And it has a dark eye. So this is supposed to be a race of the dark-eyed junco. Now we're gonna do the genetic analysis to figure out exactly what it is.
Until recently, the origin of the junco on Guadalupe has been an unsolved mystery. Their feather coloration is most similar to the pink-sided juncos in the Rocky Mountains. And they have dark brown eyes. Both feather color and eye color have led to the classification of the Guadalupe junco as a race of the dark-eyed junco species. But the DNA samples collected on Mila and Ketterson's expedition revealed that the Guadalupe junco is most closely related to the Guatemala junco in Central America, which has a yellow eye. This finding reveals how physical traits like eye color or feather color can sometimes be misleading in understanding evolutionary relatedness. The analysis also indicated that the Guadalupe juncos were highly differentiated genetically and should be classified as an independent species. Gaining status as a unique species could help this critically endangered population to receive further protection and conservation. An important future research goal is to understand how natural selection may have shaped the evolution of the Guadalupe junco's unique characteristics.
So, well, we've been trying to come up with an explanation as to why the Guadalupe junco has this very pointy bill. It's much longer, the culmen is much longer, and it also has this very pointy at the end, to the point that the upper mandible sticks out over the lower mandible in many cases. Which, you know, it looks like a forceps type bill, you know, what you would see in birds that feed on pine seeds, for example. Obviously, there's this very strong association with the cypress forest here in Guadalupe, and you know, most of the seeds that are available to the junco come from these structures. So the seeds are held inside these pods that they open when they fall to the ground and dry up. So when they're in the tree, they're completely closed. They look like this, and then they would open a little bit, and then eventually they open completely and the seeds fall out. So it would be really interesting to see if this has something to do with the shape of the bill, because that would be evidence of adaptation to this habitat, and that would explain this morphological feature of the Guadalupe junco.
Guadalupe Island's beauty is rivaled only by its fragility. While the expedition raised dozens of questions for future research, we can only hope the birds and their tiny patch of habitat will endure long enough to provide answers. A sunny Friday afternoon in May on the campus of the University of California, San Diego. Spring is in the air, and hormone levels are soaring as the competition to attract mates reaches a high point. Loud mating calls and flamboyant displays are frequent. Breeding season is an exciting time, but it can be stressful too. This rambunctious atmosphere is a far cry from the peaceful forests where juncos typically breed, especially during the school's celebration of the annual Sun God Festival. But for a select group of juncos, this radically different habitat is their year-round home. Juncos are not thought of as city birds, so their recent adaptation to the bustling campus is a surprising turn of events. But to fully appreciate what makes these juncos unique, one must first understand the population's roots. Just 60 miles east of the city of San Diego, a population of juncos breeds on Mount Laguna, representing the southern edge of the Oregon Junco breeding range. The subspecies Junco hyamalis thurberi breeds in a forest environment similar to places like the Tetons and the Black Hills. It is a mountain covered with oak and pine that rises out of the desert to an elevation of nearly 6,000 feet above sea level.
Southern California has a huge variation in topography from sea level to over 11,000 feet. Historically, with the coniferous forest only over about 4,000 feet elevation, that was the only area where the junco was known to breed.
But even at this lower latitude, winter in the mountains can be cold, snowy, and windy. So most juncos that breed on mountains, such as Mount Laguna, migrate to lower elevations, including coastal areas, during the winter. When breeding season approaches, they migrate back to the mountains. That is, until the early 1980s, when some Oregon juncos did not return to the mountains in the spring. Instead, staying to breed along the coast on the campus of the University of California, San Diego. A colonization event in which the juncos became isolated in a whole new world, not unlike the first arrivals on the Mayflower.
The UCSD campus here is situated right on the coast, so we're a few hundred feet off of sea level, up on kind of the coastal bluff, but it's really part of the greater city of San Diego. So it's surrounded by residential neighborhoods, urban settings, commercial areas. It's a college campus, so classes go on during the week, and there's all kinds of vehicle traffic, human traffic, pets, noise, light. It's very much a bustling, urban, suburban kind of setting.
Founded in the 1960s, UC San Diego has grown to an enrollment of more than 29,000 students. The campus is known for its unique architecture and modern art, including several installations inspired by the works of local resident and philanthropist Theodore Geisel, who is better known to the world as Dr. Seuss.
In thinking about the history of the colonization of the Junco at UCSD, first thing to remember is that it's not a terribly old campus. When was it first built? In the 1960s. So, and previous to that, it was sage scrub, chaparral, just like the rest of the city of San Diego. So we can go back only so far before it would have been completely unsuitable for juncos breeding. The first known sighting of them came in 1983. And that was, I believe, from Stan Wallens. He's been a very avid birder for many years, and so it's not the kind of thing that he would have overlooked.
When we moved out here, I was already completely hooked on birding. Every day, I would take a lunch, I would go birding on campus for an hour or two for the middle of the day. And I wandered everywhere through the entire campus for the entire 8 years that I was here. And it just so happens that I was taking care of my young daughter at that time, and she said, "Look, Dad, there's some juncos." And I said, Rachel, juncos are here in the winter and it's July. She said, no, Dad, they're juncos. And then she pointed to these two little birds that were underneath the bush, and sure enough, there was a male and a female junco. But she was this tall and the juncos were down there and she saw them. And she was very proud that she could better see birds than her father.
The colonist population grew from an initial flock to a small but stable size of about 80 breeding pairs. Isolated from their native breeding range by a sea of unsuitable breeding habitat, the population exists as a biogeographic island. It wasn't long before the unique situation caught the attention of scientists, including then UCSD biology professor Trevor Price.
It's pretty obvious why a junco decided to stay here. They came down here from the mountains, deeply covered in snow. They took one look at me drinking a cappuccino and said, "This is a good deal, I'm going to stay here." But what probably actually happened was that the birds themselves were singing, getting ready to leave, and enough males were singing to stimulate the females enough to start building nests. And somehow there was a critical mass action that took off.
Birds and other animals around the world have been adapting to changing environments for millions of years. But recent decades have seen unprecedented rates of habitat alteration and climate change. Some species respond successfully, while others go extinct. Seeing these juncos show up and adapt in such a short time span has allowed scientists a unique opportunity to study what biological traits have changed to make this transition possible.
When you start to look at the birds, you find that they've somehow managed to change in response to both the pressures of living in a city and the different climate. So, for example, one of the features of the mild San Diego climate is that the birds themselves just stay in San Diego all year round, whereas if you live up in the mountains, you leave the mountains and come back.
The juncos that live here must do so in harmony with a blended landscape of natural and man-made components. The new habitat presents countless challenges and novel threats. Vehicles, humans, and urban nest predators, such as cats and crows. Noise is constant, and artificial light illuminates the night. But there are opportunities, not the least of which is the mild climate. Large lawns and ornamental plants at UCSD are watered and cared for year-round, providing consistent sources of seed and insect nourishment. Decorative fountains provide limitless drinking and bathing opportunities. Food crumbs and garbage from the dozens of cafes and picnic spots provide additional foraging possibilities. Starting in 1998, UCSD graduate student Pamela Yeh led a team of student researchers that first studied the campus juncos intensively, capturing, color banding, and following each and every individual junco in the population for nearly 6 years. The research continues today, with teams from both Indiana University and the University of Chicago collaborating on recent studies. Compared to working in remote locations, field research on campus can be more convenient, but also has its fair share of awkward moments and difficulties. Among the most striking changes that Ye's team first documented was a shift in the timing and duration of the breeding season. On Mount Laguna, cold winters and hot summers restrict junco breeding from May to early June, with only a single brood of offspring raised each season. At UCSD, however, juncos start nesting in February and continue well into August, raising up to 4 broods. This dramatic adjustment of breeding schedule has had cascading effects on many other traits.
And this tendency to stay all year round and to have multiple families each year seems to have led to a suite of characters that make males much more interested in raising young than they do in chasing after mates. And we've found, for example, that the males themselves are less aggressive to each other. Importantly, that both the males and the females have less white in their tail, and white is used as an aggressive display. They have less black in their head, which is another signal of aggression used in displays. The males are better parents at the nest, as was shown by Jonathan Atwell. So there's a whole suite of characters that have evolved, we feel, in response to the longer breeding season. But over on top of that, we've got pressures or changes that have happened in response to the urban environment.
People that study animal behavior will talk about how bold or how shy individual animals or populations of animals might be compared to others. And so the juncos here at UCSD are very bold, both in terms of how close they'll allow people to get to them. They're very tame or very bold, but also in their willingness to approach novel objects or enter into new situations, you know, to potentially explore food resources or breeding habitats that they have not encountered before.
When researchers actually quantified just how bold campus juncos have become, they found that they allowed people to approach three times closer than the birds on the mountain did, and they were twice as fast and extensive in exploring novel situations. Blood samples revealed that campus juncos also keep their stress hormone levels lower during dangerous situations, likely allowing them to cope with the more chaotic and complex environment found in the city. Even the way that campus juncos communicate with one another is altered. Males sing at a higher pitch, a shift that allows their songs to be heard above the constant hum of low-frequency traffic noise. Altogether, research has revealed a long list of changes in the biology of the UCSD juncos when compared to Mount Laguna. These differences include physical characteristics, behaviors, and physiological traits. But an important question remained. Were these differences induced by growing up and living in the new environment? Or were they due to genetic differences between the colonists at UCSD and the ancestral range population at Mount Laguna? This question is similar to the nature versus nurture topic often debated in humans. But in plants and animals, scientists can more directly test this question of the relative importance of genes versus environment by using what's called a common garden experiment. By transporting plant seeds or young animals from two different locations into a common environment, researchers can raise them under identical conditions and ask which differences persist and which do not. If differences persist, it provides strong evidence for genetic divergence. If differences disappear, then they were likely induced by the different environments. Researchers conducted common garden studies with the juncos from UCSD and Mount Laguna. Nestlings and juveniles were captured from both populations, and the young birds were transported to an aviary. For more than 3 years, birds were raised under identical environmental conditions, and many of the same traits were measured as in the field studies. The results were remarkable. Many of the differences persisted. Tail white, head black, and wing lengths were still different, despite the common environmental conditions, including identical diet, temperature, and day length. Juncos taken from campus were still bolder and more exploratory, and they had lower stress hormone levels, even after identical exposure to human activity and other possible stressors. And the males still sang at higher frequencies, even without differences in background noise. These studies, along with additional genetic analyses, provide evidence that the juncos on campus evolved rapidly over the course of less than 30 years. The campus juncos join a handful of other examples that highlight an emerging scientific realization. Evolution can happen right before our eyes in response to new and changing environments.
Especially in an area like San Diego, where we've seen such a revolutionary change, it's something we can study going all around us and right in our own backyard, so to speak. Evolution isn't something that happened a long time ago. It's something that happens every day.
In 2012, biologists from around the world met at Indiana University to chart the course of future research on the Junco. Since Rowan's pioneering discovery of photoperiodism in the 1920s, Juncos have played a starring role in groundbreaking discoveries from a remarkable array of biological disciplines. From Ellen Ketterson's long-term research on testosterone and social behavior, to Borja Mila's continued quest to understand their spectacular diversification across the continent, to ongoing studies in San Diego, where they are evolving right before our eyes, Juncos continue to teach us important lessons about the natural world.
It's a very exciting time to be an evolutionary biologist right now, because we're just now being able to link some of the physical aspects we see about organisms, about birds, such as their plumage, their morphology, even their behavior, to specific genes. Up until now, it's been very difficult to actually isolate genes because really it's looking for a needle in a haystack. The size of the genome is so large and these individual genes are so small that it's been very difficult to zero in on them. Now with new sequencing technologies, what we're being able to do is sort through more and more of that haystack to find the needle. But now we can look at the entire genome, and the difference between that is probably about a million times what we could do before in the same amount of time.
Despite nearly 100 years of intensive research on the Junco, there's no end in sight to what we can learn through studying this amazing group of birds.
Hello, my name is Trevor. We can learn a lot about how to live in the city from the Junco.
We can learn about speciation from the Junco.
Adaptation.
Climate change.
The brain.
Hybridization.
We can learn a lot about violence from the Junco.
How genes affect behavior.
Reproduction.
We can learn a lot about mate choice.
Evolution.
Gene expression.
Range expansion.
Communication.
We can learn a lot about maternal care from the Junco.
And geographic variation.
Hormones.
Gonads.
Monogamy.
We can learn a lot about sex, food, and death.
Yourself.
Sensory systems.
Trait selection.
We can learn a lot about disease ecology.
Olfaction.
Plasticity.
We can learn a lot about beauty in nature from the Junco.
So the next time you see a little gray bird, maybe even in your own backyard, remember to take a second look and consider all that can be learned from the ordinary, extraordinary Junco.